May it please the court. My name is Mark Evans, number 40156, public defender here today representing Mr. Logan McClellan, who joins us in the audience. The jury's primary task in this case was to answer a single question. Was Logan McClellan acting in accordance with the law of self-defense? And to answer that question, jurors had to apply the evidence received from the witnesses to the law provided by the court. That is, after all, the job of the jury in every single trial. But here, the jury received no law on self-defense that it could apply to reckless manslaughter. And by failing to provide that law, the district court took off the table the legal concepts necessary for the jury to answer the only real question in this case. I'm happy to address any of the issues raised on appeal today, but I'm planning to focus on why that single error likely determined the outcome of this trial, and I will aim to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. My argument today is very simple and involves only 3 points. First, the district court was required to instruct the jury on the law of self-defense as applied to reckless manslaughter. Second, the district court did not provide that instruction. And third, the court's error was likely outcome determinative. Regarding the first point, abundant authority makes clear that it is simply not enough for a court to tell a jury in a reckless manslaughter case that it may consider evidence of self-defense. The court also has to provide the jury the law of self-defense to which it can apply the evidence when making that consideration. That requirement is clear from the language of the self-defense statute. It's clear from Madrogo and Lara, both of which predated Mr. McClellan's trial. And it's clear in both Pickering and the most recent version of the Colorado jury instruction.
Was this trial before or after Pickering was decided? I was just looking, do you know?
It was before Pickering was decided.
The trial was before Pickering.
I believe that's correct.
Mr. Evans, was this issue raised in the district court?
This issue is reserved for plain error, Your Honor, or reviewed for plain error.
Okay.
Although, that said, Your Honor, we did tender instructions on both reasonable belief and apparent necessity, which would have applied to all of the charges that went before the jury, and solved the problem that is being raised here today, and those instructions were denied by the district court.
Excuse me, counsel, tell me again what the instructions were on.
Your Honor, we provided an instruction on reasonable belief and an instruction on apparent necessity. Those can be found in the court file at pages 212 through 214, and the court rejected those in the jury instruction conference on the 9th of June, pages 8 through 9.
Now, would they have provided instruction about application of self-defense to the other mens rea on recklessness and criminal negligence?
If included in the jury's instructions as they were tendered, those would have applied to all offenses. So, yes.
Okay. What I need help with is understanding how this can be a plain error. Can you please address that, counsel? Given that the Pickering case had not been decided yet and the new criminal jury instruction had not yet been issued.
Okay, and Your Honor, from the get-go, I want to make clear something that I'm afraid I may have conflated in my briefs. There are really two separate issues with the instructions here. One is that they did not provide the law of self-defense to the jury, and that is completely independent from the burden issue for which cases like Pickering and Smith and Martin have been. Pickering is really only applicable to the first argument regarding the necessity to provide the law of self-defense, because it, along with abundant other authority, clarifies that what the self-defense statute says is that you have to provide the law and you have to provide that the jury may consider evidence of self-defense, and that those are two independent requirements. But going back to your question of why this is plain error, I think the best case to look at is Gross. And when you look at paragraph 5 of the Gross opinion, there the jury was provided an instruction substantively identical to instruction 18 in this case, in that it said, is an affirmative defense to crimes X and Y that the defendant used physical force. And the Colorado Supreme Court found that that instruction on its face was limited to crimes X and Y. Now here you have the additional aggravating factor that instruction 19 just plainly told the jury that the law of self-defense didn't apply. But in Gross, The Colorado Supreme Court found that was error. And so, you know, the only question in Gross was whether it rose to the point of calling into question the outcome of the case. And the answer was no in Gross, because, and only because, the way the jury was instructed in that case, they convicted on one of the offenses for which self-defense was an affirmative defense, which means the jury necessarily rejected self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt as to the criminal interaction that was at issue in that case. That is the only reason that the Colorado Supreme Court found that that did not call into question the verdict. Here, in contrast, for the two offenses where the jury was correctly instructed on the law of self-defense, the jury acquitted. And it was only for the offense, for the offenses, well, only for one of the offenses for which the jury was not provided the law of self-defense that they convicted. And this was obviously a case where self-defense was an issue. And the key part of my argument here is explaining, you know, why the elements of law of self-defense were so necessary for the jury. Like, I'd be happy to launch into that now. The instruction 18, which the court told the jury did not apply to reckless manslaughter, contained elements of law that were highly contested in this case. The concept that an individual can act on reasonable belief rather than objective necessity was only contained in instruction 18. But that concept was critical for the jury's evaluation of the evidence as to all of the offenses with which they were presented. A constant theme of the prosecutor's case was that it was not reasonable for Mr. McClellan to take action as he did because the decedent was not armed. A constant theme of Mr. McClellan's case, in turn, was that the decedent did appear to be armed and that he did not have the benefit of hindsight. So the jury had to know that the law of the state of Colorado is that you can act in self-defense based upon reasonable belief when evaluating a reckless manslaughter charge. Similarly, the law that an individual is not required to retreat before acting in self-defense was also only contained in instruction 18. Again, the prosecutor repeatedly argued that Tom McClellan could have just driven away, could have just locked the door. So the jury had to know that individuals do not have a duty to retreat before acting in self-defense in the context of a reckless manslaughter case. And Idrogo, it directly addresses that issue and found that in the absence of a no duty to retreat instruction in a reckless manslaughter case, the jury could reasonably conclude on the basis of the instructions given at trial that the failure to retreat was evidence that a lesser degree of force would not have been adequate. So that was an absolutely essential concept of law for the jury in this case. Finally, the idea that great bodily injury is relevant to justifying the use of force means only a risk of impairment to the body or a mere fracture was only contained in instruction 18 and its cross references, which the court told the jury did not apply. And here the prosecutor argued that nobody was at risk of great bodily injury. So the jury had to know exactly what great bodily injury meant in the context of reckless manslaughter.
Mr. Evans, the statute that we're dealing with, 18.1.704.4, deals with a self-defense law instruction, but doesn't define it. What is your view as to what precisely the jury should have been instructed?
Your Honor, the law contained in instruction 18, which only applied to first and second degree murder, was a correct statement of the law. That is what the jury needed to hear. But the jury needed to hear that that same law also applied to reckless manslaughter and criminally negligent homicide.
But it doesn't, because the burden of proof in instruction 18 is on the prosecutor to disprove the affirmative defense. That clearly doesn't apply to the recklessness.
And, Your Honor, I stand corrected. The burden information, at least under current Colorado law, is different. That is correct. But all of the reasonable belief of imminent injury, no duty to retreat, the risk of great bodily injury, all of that law is the same. All of that applies to reckless manslaughter cases.
So this has been fixed now by the new jury instructions, but it wasn't at the time of this trial made clear in the pattern jury instructions.
That's correct, Your Honor. It is only by carefully comparing the definition of the reckless mens rea to the law of self-defense that the jury could have reached the conclusion, as acknowledged by Pickering, that one cannot simultaneously act in self-defense and act recklessly. But the jury could not make that comparison because it was told the law of self-defense simply did not apply. This court has no further questions. I'll reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Very well, Mr. Evans.
May it please the court. My name is Victoria Cisneros, registration number 45519, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado in this matter. As the defendant noted, the jury instruction in this case is being reviewed for plain error, and so the relevant question at hand is, was any error so obvious and substantial that it undermined the fundamental fairness of this trial? And in this case, the answer is no. The law in this area had been in flux at the time of the defendant's trial. Lahren had been decided, but Pickering came out shortly thereafter. Following Pickering came Gross. And looking at Gross, the instruction was similar. There was an affirmative defense instruction given in Gross. There was an affirmative defense instruction given here. In that instruction, it contained the self-defense law. Instruction 19 then went on to instruct the jury that they could consider that evidence when determining whether the defendant acted recklessly or with criminal negligence, but the affirmative defense instruction did not apply, which is a correct statement of the law. However, the jury was told to consider the evidence of self-defense, which in Gross is where the court found error. In Gross, they stated that the court needed to instruct the jury to consider the evidence of self-defense, which is precisely what the jury was instructed to do here.
Ms. Cisneros, let me ask you a question about that. Here, the instruction 19 specifically said to the jury, don't follow instruction 18, but you may consider self-defense. So under those circumstances, what do you think the jurors would have understood that they could consider in terms of self-defense?
The jury was able to consider all of the evidence that was presented of self-defense, and that's all this case was about. Was the defendant reasonable when he shot the victim 7 times?
Well, let me ask you more specifically. I mean, the instruction 18 includes a lot of legal concepts that may be different from a layperson's understanding of the concept of self-defense. For example, that there's no duty to retreat. And here the prosecutor argued in closing argument that Mr. McClellan's father could have just driven away, suggesting that there was no duty, or that there was a duty to retreat. So under those circumstances, wouldn't the absence of a more comprehensive jury instruction have deprived the jurors of a full understanding of the concept of self-defense?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe that in closing argument, the prosecutor in the very beginning went through the elements of self-defense, stating that the defendant needed to have a reasonable belief that the victim was going to use unlawful physical force and that the degree of force that he used was necessary. And then later on, the prosecutor continued explaining to the jury that with regards to first and second degree murder, we have to disprove that the defendant acted in self-defense. But when it comes to reckless and criminal negligence, you can consider that evidence, but we don't have to disprove it. And so I believe that the prosecutor, during closing argument, walked through each element of self-defense and explained to the jury how it is to apply, even though instruction 19 stated that the affirmative defense instruction, as an affirmative defense, does not apply. Self-defense was the only issue in this trial. The only question, which the prosecutor also pointed out during closing arguments, was, did the defendant act reasonably? You're here to decide whether his actions were reasonable. You have a right to defend yourself, but it has to be reasonable. These are the things that the prosecutor continued to hammer home to the jury during closing argument.
Did he tell them that in a reckless situation, there's no duty to retreat?
He did not.
How would the jury know then that in the reckless, in applying the test of recklessness, there's no duty to retreat here if the instruction 19 said, don't consider what's in 18, or don't apply what's in 18?
they'd have to use some kind of intuition, or, and then now you see the prosecutor didn't even tell them that. How could they possibly know that there was no duty to retreat?
Your Honor, I would simply say that they still had the law in front of them. And in Gross, what the court also stated was that the evidence that the jury had to consider for self-defense for extreme indifference murder was the exact same evidence that it considered for second-degree assault. And that is the same thing here. Even if the jury had been given an extra instruction that stated the self-defense law, it would have been almost identical to the instruction 18. Because it would have laid out the same concepts.
Right, but it wouldn't have said that 18 doesn't apply.
It would not have said that, no, Your Honor. And perhaps it would have been better, wording choice could have been better if the court had said, it is not an affirmative defense to reckless manslaughter. Or if the court had given an instruction simply labeled self-defense law and then given a separate affirmative defense instruction. However, the defendant did not request a separate self-defense instruction as it related to reckless manslaughter. In this case either, nor did the defendant object to the instructions that were given. And that can indicate that at the state of the law at the time and the defendant's belief that this was a correct state of the law and that the jury was being correctly instructed given the case law at the time.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, counsel, because one of my concerns is whether the instructions that were given complied with the statute, 18-170-44.
I believe that the instructions given did comply with the statute.
Why?
Instruction 18 laid out the self-defense law listed in 18-1704, sections 1 through 3. Instruction 19 then tracked the language of 18-1704-4, stating that the defendant has raised a self-defense, he's presented that evidence, you may now consider that evidence when deciding whether the defendant acted recklessly, but it is not an affirmative defense.
I'm having trouble understanding. Because as my colleagues have pointed out, instruction 19 said not to consider instruction 18. There's something along that line that would have given the jury that impression potentially. So I'm having trouble understanding how instruction 19 could have complied with the statute.
I believe it complied with the statute as the court understood it to be then. We've now expanded in Pickering and Gross on subsection 4 to more clearly define what the instruction should state from now. And the model instructions also now help clear this up as well. We did not have the model instruction at the time. And the model instruction basically now says, did the defendant act reasonably? And that was the theme throughout this trial. It was the theme throughout the closing argument. And I believe that the jury did understand that was what they were here to decide. Was the defendant acting reasonably when he got out of the truck, came around and shot the victim 7 times?
Ms. Cisneros, in response to your comment that apparently the instruction 19 was consistent with the law at the time, what is your response in light of the Batchelor for Gates, which was decided in 2008, in which the court said that in giving a reckless or instructing the jury in determining whether the defendant acted recklessly, the jury must consider whether the defendant reasonably believed it necessary for him to defend himself or another person from the victim's use or imminent use of unlawful physical force. There was no such language in this case.
There was no such language directly to the reckless manslaughter lesser included charge, but I believe that's because it was a lesser included charge. They included the mens rea and the elements of the lesser included, but here they were instructing the jury on the lead charge, which was first degree murder. And as doing so, they provided the affirmative defense instruction. Again, it may have been better practice for the trial court to say it is not an affirmative defense in instruction 19 rather than saying instruction 18 does not apply. However, that's not the case that we have before us. And I do believe that the prosecutor made clear that self-defense is the only issue here. Here are the elements of self-defense. And when considering the instructions and the prosecution's closing argument, the jury was clear on what they were to be deciding and how to apply the law that they were given. I also think that the jury's verdicts indicate this as well. They acquitted the defendant of first and second degree murder, which could indicate that the jury believed that the defendant did not act after deliberation, nor did he act knowingly. They also acquitted the defendant of criminally negligent homicide, so they could have believed that he did not perceive the risk, but instead he perceived the risk that was present when he got out of the car, but he disregarded that risk, therefore acted recklessly when he shot the defendant, when he shot the victim. And that the jury's verdicts and the evidence in this case support that interpretation. If the court has no further questions, I would respectfully request that this court affirm the defendant's conviction.
Thank you, Ms. Cisneros.
So, Fishman, I thought you asked a really good question, but how would the jury interpret that they're supposed to apply the notion of no duty to retreat? And the answer is, they didn't have to intuit it. They would have had to affirmatively choose not to follow the court's instructions. Instruction 19 told them not to apply instruction 18. They would have had to read that and say, no, we're going to look at it anyway. And this court presumes the jury does not do that. They presume that the jury follows the instructions and therefore did not apply the concepts in instruction 18 to the charge of reckless manslaughter.
Well, I asked Mrs. Narrows if the prosecutor told the jury about the no duty to retreat. Did the defense counsel argue that there was no duty to retreat?
Your Honor, defense counsel's entire argument was about the concepts of self-defense, but it was to the charges as a whole, not specifically parsing them out. And I think it's important to recognize that this was a first-degree murder trial. Mm-hmm. And I think that everybody's energy was initially focused on that charge. The state has repeatedly asserted that the law was in flux at the time of Mr. McClellan's trial, and while the burden issue of who has the burden of proving what may have been in flux, the fact that you have to get a self-defense law instruction was not. The statute had been in place since 2003, the Doble was decided in 1991, case law that Judge Todman pointed out was pre-existing. This was not an area of the law that was in flux. The requirement was clear.
Yes, but until Pickering, until Gross, until Duran, it hadn't been expressly stated. For example, that the no duty to retreat has to be given in the reckless manslaughter case.
Your Honor, a quote from Androgo, the 1991 case. Mm-hmm. Failure to properly instruct the jury on the applicable law of self-defense deprives the defendant of the right to acquittal on those grounds if the jury could have had a reasonable doubt as to whether the defendant acted in self-defense.
Sure, but the question is, does that include the duty to retreat? We now know it does, because now there's no question about it.
Hidrogo was specifically about a no duty to retreat instruction in a reckless manslaughter case. If the court has no further questions for me, just conclude by saying that this was the closest of cases. Mr. McClellan found himself in a situation that he did not create, saw that his father was under threat, and took action to protect his father. The only question in this case was whether he was acting in accordance with the law of self-defense as established by the state of Colorado. Because the jury could not answer that question without knowing what the law was, respectfully ask this court to reverse his conviction.
As long as you have a minute and a half left, let me ask you to shift gears. Everybody's here anyway. Let's talk about those photographs that came in for just a minute. Why isn't it just, assuming it was wrong to put the photographs in, why isn't it just harmless error given the fact that the prosecutor, I guess, conceded that the victim was belligerent and intoxicated on the day of this event, that those photographs didn't depict him on the day of the event?
Well, Your Honor, it's not harmless, number one, because evidence introduced for the purpose of inflaming the jury and evoking sympathy for the decedent is, I mean, the prototypical CRE 403 should not come in evidence. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a particularly poignant issue in this case, because I mean, while the essential facts of this case are undisputed, but there are little details supporting or not supporting the self-defense argument that were. I mean, who was leaning where, when, who was struggling over what, at what time. And when the jury was evaluating that, they were presented with two fundamentally different pictures of the decedent here. And
three, actually.
Well, they were presented with the picture provided by the witnesses on the day of the event, and then they were provided with three pictures that had absolutely nothing to do with that and just painted him in an entirely different light, which had served no purpose other than to try to convince the jury that this was somehow a categorically peaceful person.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Thank you, Ms. Cisneros. We very much appreciate your helpful arguments this morning. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. As I